Well, good morning. Welcome to another episode of Off the Chain with Dave and Steele. I have some very exciting news today, and it's that Dave is not here. And the best part about today's episode is that because Dave isn't here, we have two outstanding guests who will more than double the cultural cachet and the usual contributions that Dave would bring. I am really pleased to welcome, for their very first appearance on the podcast, Rose. Hello, Rose.
Hello.
And Emmeline.
Hi, guys.
Hello. The thing that I was thinking about we'd start off talking about today was, this is quite interesting to me because I have really no point of reference for it, but homeschooling. Both of you, I understand, were homeschooled for some portion of your life. Is that accurate?
That is true.
Rose, tell me, when did you start homeschooling and what was it like for you?
I started in fourth grade. We started doing it because I was having health problems. They were actually fake, but I was having some emotional problems. anyway, so my parents were trying to find a solution when they both worked full time, and the district offered to have what they called a home teacher come, and he would check in with me once a week. Basically, what happened was he was a really, really nice guy, but he came the first day. He didn't talk to my parents. He talked to me, and he asked me what I was supposed to be learning. And so as a little fourth grader that didn't actually know what my curriculum was supposed to be, I was like, music and math and English, and that's all I knew. So
he said, I'll be back in a week. Good luck learning it.
Yeah, he went and got the textbooks from my school, so I don't know why he didn't ask them what I was supposed to be learning. But
wow.
And he brought me the textbooks, and then he would give me assignments for each week, and I just did them on my own and taught myself using the textbooks. And then he would check everything, and it would take about half an hour every week, and he would just make sure everything was correct, I guess. And
wow.
Then he would ask if I had any questions, and I didn't know if I should have any questions, so I said no, and then he'd leave.
So was he actually a licensed teacher, Rose, or was he just a guy that the district picked to do this?
I think he had been a licensed teacher. He was,
okay.
I think,
that's
like semi-retired
good.
Or something like that. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, and like I said, he was really nice. I felt really safe with him and stuff. So I still learned things, but when I got back to school, I was way behind in other things like geography.
Except for the three subjects you had been studying for the last year.
Yeah, like I really excelled at music, but.
Well, Rose, when I hear that, what I want to know is your parents were both working full time. Where
Yes.
did you go and what were you doing during the day? Like you didn't have a teacher with you during the day?
I stayed at my grandparents. So my parents lived in the same town as both of their parents.
Okay.
So I would trade off. Some days I would stay at my mom's parents and some days at my dad's parents. And they made sure I did my homework, but, you know, they had other things going on in their lives as well. So I got it all done and then I watched TV all day.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
How did you actually... did you have enough self-discipline at that age to actually get the work done?
I was really interested in not getting in trouble.
Okay.
So I would make sure I got the homework done. So a lot of times at my dad's parents, then my grandpa loved Matlock, and he would let me do my homework while I watched Matlock with him.
That should become part of the official elementary school curriculum, don't you think?
Yeah, I learned a lot about fake crime investigation. So.
We call it math with Matlock is what I would call it.
Yeah. And then like with music, I was interested in that just on my own. In English, I just read a lot anyway, so that was pretty easy.
And
yeah.
You did this for a full year, Rose, or how long were you homeschooled for?
All of fourth grade and half of fifth grade. Most of fifth grade, yeah, almost all of it.
Wow. And for you, Emmeline, what was your homeschooling experience? When did it begin and how long did it last?
I started in eighth grade and went all the way through graduation of
high
school.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So this was much later in your schooling career. Did you hear any similarities with what Rose was describing, or was yours, how would yours compare?
It sounds pretty different. My mom taught us. I was at home with my two younger brothers and for a time with my older sister, for like a year, just with my older sister. So there were a bunch of us there. My mom is an elementary ed teacher. Mm-hmm. So she has experience with teaching, and it was, I don't think I was as disciplined or frightened of getting in trouble, I guess, as Rose, because I graduated a year late because I just didn't get the work done and just didn't care until the very end when I realized, oh crap, this is actually happening and I need to do something or else I'll be stuck at home forever.
Do you think it would have been different had you stayed in public schools, Emmeline, or would that have been probably a character trait of yours?
No, I think that if I had been in public school, that's something that I think would have gone better for me, because we didn't, like, I think, to be kind to my mom, there were just so many of us there and she was in charge of so many different people's education that, and like running a house and, you know, all the other parts of motherhood, that we just didn't have as much oversight as we needed, I think, as I needed to actually get the work done.
So are you glad that you did homeschool for those years? Is that something that you would want to do for your own kids, just with more discipline, or?
Probably not. I mean, I'm glad that I did it. I'm glad that I had the experience, but I don't think I would like some time away from my kids. Looking forward to Elsa going to school and, you know, having a little time alone.
I was just thinking, I think homeschooling is really interesting. Like the parents who feel like we're going to educate our kids or set up some kind of customized individual plan for them seems really exciting. But then I was thinking, it's kind of a sweet deal that the state says, we're going to pay for us to take your children for 8 hours a day and you don't have to worry about them and they're going to be taught something. Like as an idea, that's amazing. I can't wait for that to happen.
Yes, seriously. Well, something like for me too, I mean, I didn't even have my siblings with me. There's such a big age gap for me as well. But when I got back to school, my social skills, it was only like 2 years, right? But my social skills were really lacking and it took me several years to catch up. So
you mean there weren't a lot of schoolyard conversations about Matlock?
Yeah, not really.
Dang it.
I can definitely identify with that.
Yeah, it was like, how do you interact with people your own age?
What happened for you when you went to college, Emmeline? Because you were coming from being homeschooled with three other kids, I guess, in Alaska, and then all of a sudden, a tiny city of 30,000 college students.
Yeah, I think I was to an age then where it wasn't so difficult. And honestly, like, going to Young Women's every week, like, I went to Mutual every week because it was my only social outlet. And that was really helpful to figure out how to talk to people. And I had my siblings there. So that's one big bonus, I think, that came from being homeschooled with them, that we're really close now.
That does sound great. I think having all that time together. The thing that strikes me actually listening to this is it sounds like pretty minimal oversight. The state says normally we would be educating you, but if you want to be homeschooled, that's okay. And just go for it. Like, didn't the state board of education say, like, here's the minimum, this is what you need to do? And how do they verify that you're actually doing anything?
In Alaska, I think there are different rules. Is that right, Rose? Different rules in different states?
I think that states are allowed to control the curriculum. Like, they get federal funding based on meeting certain federal guidelines, but mostly it's up to the state.
Like, we had to go in for for testing every semester. We had testing that we would go into our little office
and prove that you had learned something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't remember if they had standardized testing for elementary school back then. I don't know, because I don't remember taking standardized tests. That was the new thing for me when I started going back to school. So
you just saw that guy every week for half an hour, and that was your
We talk about how he flew like little Cessna planes. My mom flew those too. So it was like, let's talk about your activities.
So. Smart. You're already on your way to winning friends and influencing people, Rose.
Yeah. I think part of it, like the district, I think had limitations on what as far as financially, they could afford to provide to somebody who was supposedly sick, who needed education, but couldn't be at school.
Well, this is fascinating. I'd love to talk about it in more detail some other time. But I think today we've got an exciting show lined up. And the things that we wanted to cover, we want to do a special segment of Small Talk, where we help socially awkward people with things to talk about in their next socially awkward conversation. We want to do a little bit of expert testimony, where we talk with both Emmeline and Rose about their creative pursuits and things that they have some expertise in. We're going to talk a little bit about everyday heroes, some people from our lives who we think are amazing or have done something fantastic without a lot of public notoriety. We're going to do a special episode of Unchained Melodies with some foreign language music. And then we have, as always, a segment of book wisdom to close out. So a lot to cover. So let's get started with Small Talk. Ladies, what can you contribute to help people with their next awkward conversation?
This is a subject I don't actually know that much about, so maybe that's why it's so crazy to me.
Perfect.
But I read an article about how researchers found a new part of the lymphatic system that connects the brain to the lymphatic system. I know it has going to have a huge effect possibly on how they treat diseases like multiple sclerosis and Alzheimer's and autism. So they can now look at really what reactions are happening in the body and stuff. But mostly what was crazy to me was that there are pieces of the body that we hadn't discovered yet.
Wow.
Like physical aspects of the body. And that was crazy to me.
So I was just reading this link that you shared, Rose, and I'm not an anatomist. I know very little about the human body, to be frank. But they're suggesting that for many, many years, they thought there was no connection between the brain and the immune system, basically. But that they found vessels, like something that's carrying information between the brain and the lymphatic system or the lymph nodes.
Yeah. Apparently, they just had to look at the brain from a different angle. And this allowed them to see a part of the brain, you know, that you don't look at. And they found it. So, like, this to me is because it seems like the body is so... We may not understand all of the workings of things yet, but it seemed to me like we really know what's there.
Yeah, like, you know? We've mapped the whole genome or something. You know, that was my understanding. Like, we know everything that's there. We just are trying to put together how it works.
Yeah, exactly. It would be like finding a whole new set of islands in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean or something.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Fascinating. All right. We should ask Dave about this when he comes back, because he had an autoimmune disorder where his immune system was attacking his body. Could have just happened and in his brain, I guess. Now, Rose, we know.
Yeah.
On his head.
All in his head. Yeah.
And that means something different now.
Yeah, it really does. Emmeline, what do you have for Small Talk this week?
Well, I found this in my favorite magazine.
Martha Stewart
Real
Living?
Real Simple.
Oh.
No, that's my second favorite.
Dang it.
Real Simple. And they always have this cool section of interesting little tidbits that you can learn about. So this is a study that was published recently in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They found that the word mother, or one of its variants, is one of only 23 words that has been in use in those forms in use since the last ice age, like 15,000 years ago.
That's crazy.
It's something called an ultra conserved word, which means that the word changes in sound so slowly that they keep their ancestry, basically.
Huh.
And amongst mother were the words hand, fire, worm, to spit, and man. Those were some of the other ultra-conserved words. So I just thought that was kind of interesting.
You could make some really amazing sentences from those ultra-conserved words.
Uh-huh.
It's my worm mother. She just spit on the fire.
If you think about the word, it does sound like what it... Like
yeah,
word
that's
sounds
true.
Like the action. You know?
It's almost onomatopoeia, right? It's like spit.
Yeah.
So they think that a word mother or something like it has been in use by human beings for the last 15,000 years, you said?
Yep.
Holy cow.
Oh, and then another interesting thing was that this study says we lose 20% of our core vocabulary every 700 to 1,000 years. But these ultra-conserved words stick around.
That's super fascinating. I love that as someone who's interested in language. That's cool. I had no idea.
Mamas are important.
Okay, so mine's
Father's not, apparently.
Yeah, but man. I guess man is still in there somehow. I'm your mother. That's just a man.
That's the man.
That's so fitting, really. Okay, so mine's similar, Emmeline, in a way that it's about language and language shifts, but it's much, much newer. So first, the background for this story is when Laurel used to be on Facebook, my wife, and she just got off Facebook. But before she got off, we'd take turns feeding the baby and putting him down. And then when he was down, she'd be in the other room, often pumping, and I'd have just put Cedar down. So I'd have the little iPad with me, and I'd get on, and we'd send each other messages. So we'd be communicating back and forth, like in a little cute way. And we used Facebook Messenger, and we discovered those stickers. Have you guys ever used the stickers for Facebook Messenger?
On occasion.
They were like the greatest discovery in our marriage for a while. For a while, we were just almost exclusively communicating through Facebook stickers. And we would just go back and forth for like half an hour at a time, just funnier and funnier and funnier, until one of us would laugh out loud and we have to come into the same room and just talk about the stickers that we sent each other. But it was awesome. I didn't even know they existed. And then they changed our life.
When people first started using those with me, I kind of thought of it as like juvenile or something. But then when I started using it, I was like, there's so much you can say with these.
Isn't it true? That's how I felt too. So I wanted to learn more about them. I was like, what did these Facebook stickers come from? And I'm not a cell phone texter or anything, but I know the expression emoji, right? And so I found this great article about the evolution of emoji in New York Magazine. It's by a guy named Adam Sternbaugh, and he's talking about how quickly emoji have come to be and how ubiquitous they've become in internet kind of online conversation. And the story with emoji is fascinating. So they were invented in Japan, as you might imagine. This was the late 90s. There was a guy named Shigetaka Kurita, and he worked for a Japanese telecom company, and they wanted to distinguish their pager company from other pager companies. So he says, why don't we put cartoon images into our messaging functions to appeal to teens? So they call them emoji, which means in Japanese, picture word. And they started with 176 basic symbols, like smiley faces, music notes, etc. And they were really, really popular in Japan. In 2007, Apple realizes, hey, we built the iPhone, and we and Google both realized that we need to crack the Japanese market to appeal to youth. We have to include emoji somehow. So they buried an emoji keyboard in the iPhone. It wasn't supposed to be used or found by people really outside of Japan. But eventually, some North American users figured out how to use it, and they hacked it. And so if they downloaded a Japanese language app, it gave them the ability to use emoji in their phone. And that's where emojis basically came from. It's within the last 5 years, essentially.
It feels like they've been around forever.
Doesn't it? And I'm sure something like them has existed.
Yeah.
But they're built now, the way that emoji work, they're built into something called Unicode, which is the kind of standard set of characters that you can use on your computer and your keyboard. And there's a big article. This article is written because there were 722 symbols that were hard-coded, but they just announced 250 new emoji symbols are going to be added.
Oh, man.
Cloud with rain is being added. Dark sunglasses. Reversed hand with middle finger extended. That's one of the new ones. And my favorite one, I don't know whatever use you'll have for this, but it's called man in business suit levitating. So if you want to know more about emoji and you're fascinated by them, I highly, highly recommend checking out this article.
What I really liked from the article was learning that a pile of poo is a sign of good luck in, what is it, in Japan?
Yes. They're golden poo charms. The golden poo.
Well, think about it. I mean, like, what does poo do? It actually helps things grow. So
that's true. Good point.
Yeah, good perspective. Yeah. They obviously didn't have young children and weren't changing diapers every day, because I don't think of it as good luck.
No, that's like the worst sound. They're like, oh, bad omen.
I love that's one of the original emoji. They're like, you know, we only have a certain number of characters. gotta make sure we include the smiling pile of poo.
Yeah. That says something about Japanese teenagers in the late 90s, too, though.
It really does. Teen culture is awesome. That's what it says.
I know.
So the argument that this person was making, what he's saying, this rapid change, if you look at internet-based communication like on Twitter, emojis are more commonly used in mass than the letter 5, for example. And the crying joy, the joy emoji, the smiling face with tears coming out of it, is more widely used than the tilde symbol, which has been around for like hundreds and hundreds of years and is like essential in many languages. So that kind of stuff was crazy to me, how rapidly this has become part of our communication, how it's just everywhere now.
I wonder if it will change how quickly like our core words disappear.
All of our core words start disappearing more quickly because we have emoji now. We don't need them anymore.
You don't need the word mother anymore. You just use no way. The emoji of a woman and a baby.
Just crying face and praying hands. That's yeah. The mother emoji. Oh, that's great. You know, I was thinking about this because I have a coworker and we have a chat app at work, and we were considering writing a full novel or a short story just in our emoji symbols. And then I read about this, and the book Moby Dick has been rewritten in emoji. It's called Emoji Dick, and it looks terrible.
It sounds terrible.
Yeah, Moby the name Dick. Doesn't look really bad.
Yeah, that's not a great selling name, I don't think.
Yeah, I think you can download the emoji keyboard for that.
Everybody just uses the eggplant for that, I think, anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
See, that's another thing I didn't know.
Yeah.
Now I know. If Spence sends me any suggestive text.
You know how to do some sexy banter in emoji now, Emmeline. Yeah. Oh, this is great. So we got small talk covered. The lymphatic system's connected to the brain. Mothers have been talked about since the last ice age. And Facebook stickers and emoji, it's the way to go. That's the only way to communicate if you're a Japanese teenager. So we want to do a special segment now. It's called Expert Testimony. And in this segment, we've been asking our guests to talk about stuff that they're experts in. And I don't really know where to begin because I feel like both of you are super multifaceted, pretty much jack of all trades type women. But Rose, as you were kind of bringing this question up, I wanted to ask about for you filmmaking, writing, art, the kind of creative life. And Emmeline, you also, when I think of you, I think of incredible talent with quilting. Like the quilt that you made is one of the most beautiful art objects I've probably seen that I know someone has made. So the first question for both of you is, how do you balance your creative life with the rest of life responsibilities, including parenthood?
Well, I know that I am really not expert at that. I feel like every day is a struggle to figure out how to do that. And sometimes I even feel kind of guilty that it is a struggle. I feel like I should know where my priorities are, if that makes sense. So it's like, you should just not even worry about it. But then on the other hand, then I feel like it's really important to keep the creative things going in my life, and that will actually help me as a parent. So this is actually a big question for me, is like, how do you balance it? I spend most of my time, like, you know, these are the things that I do. Right now, our baby will not take naps in his bed, and he takes like 2 to 3 hour naps in my arms. And at first, this was really stressful because, well, it still can be. But anyway, it just seemed like so much time where I was just like staring at my wall or that sort of thing. But I figured out that I can still write while I'm holding him. I just do it one-handed on my phone, and then later at night then I go in and I transfer what I wrote on my phone into my computer, and it helps me do like a second revision on that. And so that's become my process, and that's like one little trick that I've learned.
That's amazing. How do your arms not break after 3 hours?
Oh yeah. That's been a problem. I actually have developed pain in my fingers on the arm that he normally sleeps on. So.
Yeah. We think Laurel's getting carpal tunnel, actually. She needs to go to the doctor for it, probably from holding Cedar. It's bad.
Oh, wow.
Babies. They just need stuff. It hurts.
They do. It's true.
Well, Rose, I wanted to ask you, actually, you talked about it's a struggle, but I want you to say, like, what is the struggle for you? Can you articulate what the struggle is that you are feeling?
Well, partly one of my commitments as a parent I had going into it is I wanted to make sure my kids knew that I was interested in them as people, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. And I find it, I am not naturally a hardworking person, if that makes sense. And so to have a lot of things I'm trying to do can be really stressful for me, and I can get really focused on those things. And so when I'm playing with my son, for instance, I'll be thinking about, like, if I can just get him to play on his own for a minute, then I'll run into this other room and I'll work for like 5 minutes because I work part-time still from home. Mm-hmm. Or I'll be able to work on something with my book or something like that. And I find that I will not be focusing on him. And I think in some ways, he needs to learn how to play by himself sometimes. But I think it becomes like an all-consuming, all-day concern. Okay, when can I have my next time to run off and do something instead of focusing on him? And so I worry that I'm like kind of in trying to do one thing that's a commitment for me, I'm failing at one of my commitments as a parent as well or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yep.
I think what I hear, Rose, is like this, and I think it's endemic to parenting generally, because I feel I identify with that pretty strongly, this desire, like, I want to be fully present with my child when I'm with my child, but I also mm-hmm. need time to be present with myself and my adult interests, including the interests that make me happy as a person. And my child does contribute to my happiness, but there are other things outside of my child that also are really important for my happiness. And most of the time, those demands aren't cleanly delineated, and it's tough to figure out when and where those go in my life.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that's like, to me, that's what the struggle is where do you fit things in?
Is that something you feel similarly to or different, Emmeline?
I do. Maybe I've just given up. I don't know. I do feel like since Addy is now at an age where he can play with Elsa, they entertain each other for a long time, like large parts of the day when Elsa's not being like horrible to him. So I have to like pay attention to that. But it does help that they play together. I have more time for stuff that I need or want to do. Yeah, I think it's true that I have given up in some ways. Like I haven't sewn anything, which used to be a huge passion of mine for, I don't know, probably a year. But I feel like my passions have sort of shifted.
Sure.
Like I cook a lot more than I used to, and that works really well because I need to feed my family anyway. And so that's nice. Like I can make that a passion of mine, trying out a new recipe, which is super fun, but also practical. Take care of that responsibility. And then like I haven't sewn anything for a long time, but we moved into this house just under a year ago, and so it's an older house. It needs some work, but it's awesome. It has cool character. And so I find that that's become a new interest of mine, like figuring out how I want. Like recently I finished up Addie's room. So it's painted now. I spent some time deciding on what colors I wanted and like what curtains and just figuring out how I wanted that to look. And that was really, really fun and fulfilling for me. And that needed to be done, or it didn't have to be, but that's something that I wanted to do, and it worked with having kids at home. So
you're using a creative interest there to, kind of doing double duty in a way.
Yeah, exactly. It's an outlet for my creativity that works with my other responsibilities.
I would say, Rose, actually, for me, Emmeline, that's something that really rings true. This podcast is one of the creative outlets for me right now. And it's not super creative, and there's things that I probably should be doing instead of it. But it feeling double duty in a way as well, because mostly the guests are friends of mine that I want to talk to. I'm like, I want these friendships to be rich and important. I'm not doing a great job at it. It's hard with parenting, fitting this all in. But if we had this regular date once a week, Dave and I are like better friends now than we've ever been. Because pretty much once a week, we talk for about an hour. And we bring in our other friends and we catch up with them. And so doing double duty, as Emmeline said, is totally the way to go. And it doesn't always work for like real, like artistic creative projects. As you're saying, like if you wrote your novel about your son, maybe that'd be double duty. But that may not be the novel that you want to write, obviously.
Plus, that'd probably just mess him up.
So. Exactly. Yeah, you got to wait till he's a teenager.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing I do think, like, that I try to remind myself is when I look at my parents, their creative pursuits, even though maybe they weren't specifically focusing on me at the time, like, they've all blessed my life and my outlook on life and have, like, influenced the person I've become, right? So I try to remind myself that that, in some ways, is really part of who I want to be as a parent.
Yeah, definitely. And I wanted to ask, actually, Emmeline, you were talking about having Atticus at home and having Elsa as the older kid has been really fun because they occupy each other. Mm-hmm. How has having the second kid been different from having the first one? Because I think for, I can't speak for Rose, but I know Rose and I just have the one. And I think it feels pretty all consuming. And you describing that sounded like amazing. What a great reason to have a second child. But I don't know if that's accurate. What's having a second been like for you?
It has been a lot easier in a lot of ways. I mean, from the very beginning, we were more emotionally prepared for the change. Like having Elsa, oh my goodness. I was depressed, definitely depressed for the first, like, probably 4 months after her birth.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak for Spence, but I think he's probably too. But with Addie, like, we kind of knew what was going to happen. And there were still a lot of struggles. Like, nursing was still... oh, it was horrible. But we expected that. And so now that they're older, it's great. I mean, I still want to get rid of them sometimes. Like this past week was really tough. I was not happy with Elsa much of the time. But there are moments where it's really fun. And I can see why people have like multiple kids.
Wow, a ringing endorsement. No, I think that's a nice perspective, Emmeline, because I feel we're with Cedar. He's 15 months now, and he's so mobile and so fearless. I feel like it's definitely a stage with him where we almost always have to be in eyesight because uh-huh. He'll climb stairs and he'll do dangerous stuff, and we sort of need to be close by. And he'll walk into the street. He's just reckless. And then I realize he's playing with all these neighborhood kids who are so good to him, and I'm like, wait. I almost never see these neighborhood kids' parents. Once he gets to be 3 or 4, he's going to be able to play outside for big chunks of the day, and we can do what we want. It's only going to get better.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Elsa is such a bossy girl, like a bossy person. I think that's just her personality. Maybe it's that she's the oldest. I don't know. So sometimes that's not good for Addie, but a lot of times she's bossy in a benevolent way. So she's like watching out for him and she notices when he does something new, like the other day. So he took his first steps the other day, which was so exciting. We were holding a cupcake for him and he walked towards it.
That seems so sugar. Fitting, Emily.
And she noticed that. She was like, Addie took some steps. And she just notices when he does something new and cool or dangerous. So she's kind of my eyes and ears most of the time.
That's great, actually, having a little helper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like she comes into the kitchen pretty much every evening and she's like, Mama, I want to be your helper and aww. Helps with dinner as much as she can, you know? She's very interested in that kind of thing.
Huh.
So it's fun.
That's awesome.
So here's the other question, I guess. We moved quickly to parenting. We gave up creative stuff. Let's talk parenting.
Yeah.
We all have boys that are within a year age of each other. What have been the biggest surprises for you in having a boy child or a man child?
So as Addie gets a little older, it's surprising how much he fits the stereotype of a boy. Like he can throw a ball and he can work with tools. He loves screwdrivers. He will like carry a screwdriver around the house all day. And I'm afraid he's going to poke his eye out, but he loves it. And he gets so mad when I take it away. So that's his toy. That's his favorite thing.
Cedar's a bit like
and
that too.
He's like, is he?
He's for him. He's in love with trucks, big construction equipment. And I'm like, that's so boy stereotype. I don't care about trucks. Laurel doesn't care about trucks. We've never liked them. But he's just like, truck, truck, points at trucks and makes engine sounds all day. And we're like, what is this?
Well, yeah, and Addie loves to wrestle. Like one day, Elsa was laying on her bed. I was getting them ready for their nap. And he just crawled over to her and like clobbered her. And so every day physical, now huh? we have wrestle time. Yeah. And he's always the aggressor. He's a little bit brutal.
That sounds like Cedar. Yeah.
That is something that one of the big surprises for me was that Felix shows affection by like slapping you in the face really hard. But it's like he's really excited. That's what he does to his toys that he's really excited about. He does this like repeated slap with both of his hands. And he'll do it to you like right in the face. And like, so you're trying to tell him like, don't hit people. But at the same time, it's like he's clearly doing it because he loves you. So.
Love through mauling. That's what they call it.
Yeah. Another surprising thing to me, because I was the youngest in my family, and there are 4 years between me and my next sibling, who's a boy, but male genitalia.
Yes.
Yes.
So, like, I didn't know. He was only, like, 4 months old, and one morning I got him up and was changing his diaper, and he had this, like, enormous erection, and I was like, does this happen already?
Yeah, usually when I change Cedar right after a nap, that's when he tends to be morning wood, they call it when you're older.
Yeah, so I was like, I thought that started in adolescence, but...
I was a little shocked by just how much, when we were changing Cedar as a young kid, how much he just felt so liberated by having the diaper off and just hands down there grabbing, tugging. It was like, if it wasn't attached, it would have come off. I mean, the kid loved it. Well, and how far they can pee when you pull the diaper off and you, it's a jet. They've got powerful muscles down there.
Well, I was surprised before we had Addie, everyone was saying, oh, you're so lucky. Boys are way easier to change, like their diapers. And I do not find that that's true at all, especially because we had him circumcised. And that was like, I had to be so delicate with everything. And I was so exhausted. And I thought it was much harder to keep everything, yeah, all those nooks and crannies clean.
Oh, speaking of. The decision to, like, whether to circumcise or not, I didn't realize how hard that was going to be for me.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, just, like, because on one hand, I think, like, oh, you're, like, especially when you think about, like, female circumcision, you think of mutilation.
Yeah.
And stuff. But then I think, I can't imagine, like, just with diaper rash and stuff, then part of me thinks, like, how do you deal with cleaning in there? And then when there is, like, a six-year-old kid, and you're trying to teach him to keep... I don't know, because I've never dealt with that. So
this is something that actually surprisingly has never come up with Dave and I on the podcast yet. I'm really disappointed, but we need to start off the chain circumcision as a new running segment. Yeah. This was something Laurel and I discussed, obviously had to make a decision for Cedar. And so Cedar, I shouldn't be talking about him by name and talking about a decision because we're years from now have this record of his parents discussing his penis. But
yeah.
Cedar is not circumcised. We didn't circumcise him. And it was kind of an easy decision for us to make. But as we were doing the research, the most common reason for parents circumcising their children in the U.S., there's some health and cleaning stuff, but the evidence is kind of, it's a wash either way. But it's that the parent is circumcised. Most people do it because the father is, and the son should be whatever the father. I don't know, because they feel like, I don't really understand exactly why that's the powerful motivator, but it is. And so I was circumcised, and Cedar is not. And so... it's going to be a learning experience for our whole family, I imagine. There's things that we'll have to explain to him or whatever. But I imagine it won't be impossible. It won't be too hard, you know.
Well, yeah. And how often do you see your father's penis, I wonder?
It hasn't been a regular experience in my life.
Okay.
Every family's different. But I think it's scout camp in the showers. So that was probably the last time.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess, yeah. I think, yeah, culturally, I think men still have more opportunities to have that experience with their same-gendered parent than women do.
Yeah. Well, there we go. I mean, expert testimony. We covered all the important topics. The creative life, second baby, and circumcision. Last question on this topic, actually. For both of you women, do you feel like you were born in the right era? And if not, what time period do you think you would feel most at home, if not the present?
I can't imagine living any other time.
Hmm.
I mean, I can't imagine living in past eras. Just because I think women have it pretty good here, at least here in my culture, they have it pretty good compared to how it seems like they were treated in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
I would get too angry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think as a woman, I think that question becomes hard because if you're just talking like style or sometimes like certain customs, like in some ways I sort of love the, not the pomp, but like 1800s where it's like you get dressed for dinner in a specific outfit. And like the idea of like having these like very ingrained customs, but they all have to do with like style and things like that and being very like, you know, like little delicacies of life. And so you have to be a certain economic like level to have that be fun.
Totally. With the style, I would choose the 20s.
1920s?
Yeah, me too. Yeah. 20s or 30s.
Like, I think also, yeah. Rose, when they bring in the future, when everybody's dressing steampunk, you will be our vanguard. You will be bringing it all back.
Yeah, so I think like, well, Emmeline's going to have to sew all the clothes. So.
Okay. You can hire me.
I like it. Well, the next thing we want to talk about, this moves on really well. We actually all picked women for this next segment, which is fitting. But this is a new segment that I wanted to do called Everyday Heroes. And Dave and I like to celebrate things on this show that are just amazing, that make us happy. And I was thinking, why not take some time and talk about some person who's either mostly forgotten or underappreciated, who we just think is amazing and deserves to be recognized as a hero. So who wants to start? Anybody have an everyday hero they want to tell us a little bit about and why they're an everyday hero?
Well, mine is the author, Dini Lowe, who is also my mom.
Hey! And,
when you mention everyday heroes, then she's the first person that came to mind. And then I tried to think of other people. But when I mentioned it to Jordan, she was the first person that came to mind for him, too. So I was like, I'll just do her. Because she's like the opposite of me. Like, she is extremely hardworking. And she, just as long as I can remember, then she's just had a lot that she's had to do and done very cheerfully. So, like, I think her whole life she wanted to be an author, but she also wanted to be a full-time mom. So when she started having children, she had the same conflict that I did as far as balancing creativity. And she would wake up at like 4 a.m. to write. And wow. Yeah. And she had not been able to finish her bachelor's degree before getting married. And when she started having kids, my dad was in the military and he was moved all over the world. And she didn't get a chance to do it until I was in junior high or elementary school. Wow. And she was working full time. She was taking care of all of us. And she had 6 children, and one of them was gravely ill for a long time. And then she was still trying to get her bachelor's degree and work on her writing, and then get her master's degree, and then get her doctorate degree. And now she's working full-time, more than full-time, working 2 jobs, and she's still trying to forward her career as a writer. She's been published, but it hasn't taken off as quickly as maybe some of her other author friends and things, so... I can imagine it's got to be super hard for her to watch some of her friends just have, in some ways, kind of seemingly easy success, and she just has to keep working and working and working at it. Wow. And she's 66 years old now, and she's still going strong. I said before, like, watching my parents and the way that they've tried to pursue their creativity, it's really affected who I am as a person, and it's made a huge difference in my life, and I know it's made a difference in my siblings' lives, and even my mom works as a teacher. So like the lives of her students and things. So.
You know, Rose, we went to a wedding of a mutual friend in Washington, D.C., and I stayed at your apartment. And while I was there, I read your mother's book. That was my first encounter with her. Is it Miss Sophronia? Was that how you pronounce it? No.
Petronella.
Sophronia, yeah. Petronella. Okay.
Very similar.
Petronella Saves the Day or something. What was it called? Tell us about the book.
Petronella Saves Nearly Everyone. The title. Yeah, and it's like P.G. Wodehouse meets Jane Austen, I guess. Mm-hmm.
That's a great description.
It's young adult fiction. It's just really fun. It's about an aristocratic teenage girl who's just like come of age at the turn of the century, and her uncle accidentally swallows this exotic bug that gives him... kind of the like insect powers and an interest in eating other insects, which is like highly inappropriate for their culture. And they solve mysteries together. So,
who wouldn't want to read that book? I have to say, it was delightful.
Spence and I read it, and we are sad that there is not a sequel yet.
Well, she self-published the second one because she hasn't. So it's on Kindle, I think.
Okay.
I'll give like the link to you guys.
Okay.
We will include it in on the podcast website as well, Rose. Your mother is a wonderful everyday hero. And I have to ask, if you had to distill it, what is the trait in your mother that for you is most heroic or most exemplary in the way she conducts her everyday life?
So her family is German, and mm-hmm. they had a family motto that was Das muss gehen, which is like, it must go, or it must happen. It just has, you have to go forward. And I think that's what it is she just keeps pressing forward and keeps trying, putting one foot in front of the other.
Love it. Thanks, Rose. So I'll share my everyday hero quick, but my everyday hero is a woman that I've never met. Her name is Vel Phillips, and she's still living. She's now in her 80s, but she is one of my like everyday Wisconsin heroes. So she was born in Milwaukee in 1924. She was a great student. She won a scholarship, and she went to Howard University, which is in Washington, D.C. area. It was at the time the preeminent African-American university. It's where a lot of really great leaders were trained and educated. She met and married a fellow student there, and she was admitted to the UW-Madison Law School in 1951 and became the first African-American woman to attend law school. 1951 was how late it was, which is stunning to me. They moved to Milwaukee, they're raising their family, and she realizes in Milwaukee things are not good for African-Americans then and now. So she ran for a seat on the school board. She won the primary but lost the election. She joined the NAACP, and in 1956, she won a seat on the city council. She was, the first woman to serve, the first African-American woman on the city council. And at the time, they were called aldermen, and so she became Madam Alderman rather than calling her an alderwoman, which I think is hilarious in its own way.
Yeah.
She proposed a fair housing law in 1962. To make it illegal to discriminate against people based on race. It was voted down over and over again. For 6 years, helped participate in nonviolent protests, and there was a famous Catholic priest named James Groppi. Every night for, I think, a couple of years, they would march from the inner part of the city across the bridge into South Milwaukee. Every night, they would just go every day. And dozens of people would go. A lot of angry people responded, and they just did this peaceful march, basically saying, we want fair housing, we want to end housing discrimination. And in 1968, after 6 years, they finally passed the law that Vel Phillips had written 6 years before for the city council. And then she went on to become the first African-American woman to become a judge in the state of Wisconsin and was elected Secretary of State in 1978. She's still alive. She's writing a memoir of the civil rights movement in Milwaukee. And just, I think, one of those people that you just look at their lives and it's the same kind of thing where it's someone that says, I see a need in my community. I want to do whatever I can to fill it, no matter what it costs me. And for that, I think she's a true hero.
That's amazing. Just the way to like find, like, how do you address a problem that you see and then actually going and doing it.
Especially when you have the cards stacked against you, like it sounds like she did.
Totally.
That's cool.
Yeah. All right, Emmeline, who's your everyday hero for us?
Well, I don't know this lady, so I don't have a lot of information about her, but I admire her a lot. Her name is Anna Maria Horner, and she is a fabric designer that I really admire. I did meet her once at a quilt show, which was, I was having trouble keeping my composure because I was so excited to meet her.
Was it off the chain?
It was. It was definitely OTC. And she just has beautiful, beautiful designs that I've bought some of them. And she has a blog that I read on occasion. And something that I really admire about her, relating to what we were talking about before, is that she has 6 or 7 kids. I can't remember which. She has like a child who's in college, and then her youngest is maybe 2. So a lot of kids spread out, and she married really young. Like, I've read a little bit of her story. Her first child was conceived out of wedlock, which was a big no-no in her family. But the child's father, they got married and they're still together, which I think is amazing and I suspect pretty rare.
Hard to do.
And that they've had, you know, just that they seem to have a happy family life. I think that's really encouraging and cool. And that through her mothering, she still is able to produce this beautiful stuff, beautiful patterns and beautiful fabric. And she does everything. She does knitting and she does sewing and quilting. And I just really admire her for continuing to be creative, even though she's obviously pretty busy.
That's exactly what we were talking about earlier, I guess. Yeah. That kind of answer, having a role model in that. Yeah, being a maker and being a parent as well.
That's cool. On her blog, I just like quickly looked over some of the stuff, and I like some of her ideas about beauty and pulling the philosophical into it.
Totally. And she's a good writer. Like, she doesn't post on her blog often, but I mean, when she does post, it's often really beautifully written and very thoughtful.
Thank you, Emmeline. Thanks for these everyday heroes. We should make this a segment more often. Dave always likes to do like superhuman adventurers and action heroes, and we need to make it more everyday, I think. More women on the show. That was Rose's loving complaint. She said, hey, there's a lot of dude stuff on the show. Could you talk about women a little bit more? And she was totally right. So Unchained Melodies, the theme this week, foreign language power. All of the songs that we've chosen this week are sung in languages other than English. And I thought this was really fun. There were some great tunes. I want to start with you, Emmeline. You got two great songs for us. Which one do you want to play for us first?
Meglio Stasera.
Ooh, you said that so elegantly.
Spence has been teaching me.
So what's the song and what's the story?
The English title is It Had Better Be Tonight. So it's a little bit of a sexy song.
Sounds like it, yeah.
It is sexy.
And it's from the Pink Panther.
And this is, who's the singer?
Performed by Fran Jeffries in the clip. Meglio stasera che domani, oh my, domani chi lo sa, perché sarà, non mi dire d'aspettare, il domani che verrà, è una porta che tu chiudi. Stasera ti decidi a rispondermi di sì, i domani che verranno li dedico solo a te. Meglio stasera che domani, oh mai, domani chi lo sa quel che sarà.
That is, I can understand why it's called It Better Be Tonight. She's slinking around.
Yeah, those pants are, her hips.
That's what the shot starts with. I was like, oh, man, I'm going to have to tell my wife I saw this.
Confession.
Yeah, 60s actually would, like, give to the 20s a run for its money.
It's true. Those clothes are some good. So, and the hair and makeup, too.
And you were saying, Emmeline, it's obvious that she doesn't speak Italian from how she delivered it, but it still sounds pretty convincing to me.
Yeah, Spence was making fun of it.
Well, I love how she kind of just, like, owns it. But
she does.
Like, her O's are so cute American girl O's, you know?
Rose, you put in a band here that you're going to share a song from somebody called the Peter Pan Complex. Is that really the name of this band?
Yes. Well, in Korean, you would say Peter Pan Complex.
Even better.
My accent's really bad. But they actually go by the English name, Peter Pan Complex. And they're an indie band. Two main people are the drummer, who's a girl, and then the singer, a guy. I don't know their names. So, I first heard them with some songs that reminded me of Radiohead. And then I came across this song. And it's just so fun. I'm having a bad day when I listen to this, and I feel a lot happier.
So what is the song called?
The English title is can't take my eyes off of you. In Korean, and my accent's not great, but it's 조금만 눈이 마주쳐. 조금만 눈이 마주쳐 심장이 타올라와 너에게 다가가서 말을 걸어
I think it's almost impossible to listen to that without just grinning. I was like, I just felt ecstatic almost.
Yeah, I know. Well, I love watching him sing too because it's like vowels are so big.
Yeah, it was like overexcited lounge singer almost. I don't know how to describe.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Great. Emmeline, are you a Peter Pan Complex fan? Is this a band that you already knew?
I am now.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, that's how I feel. All right, so here's my song for you both. This is a female rapper. Her name is Anna Tijoux, A-N-A-T-I-J-O-U-X. I think she's fantastic. Raps in Spanish. And this song is 1977, the title, but she says it in Spanish. And so here it is.
1970. Nací un día de junio del año 77, planeta Mercurio y el año de la serpiente. Signo patente tatuado y en mi frente que en el vientre de mi madre marcaba el paso siguiente. Nacer llorar sin anestesia en la camilla, mi padre solo dijo es Ana María. Sí sería el primer llanto que me probaría, que mandó las heridas y dándome la batería. Solía ser entonces como un libro abierto, pero leí la letra pequeña del texto. Como un arquitecto construyendo cada efecto, correcto, incorrecto, se aprende todo al respecto. Saber que algunas personas quieren el daño, subir peldaño toma tiempo, toma año. Con mi peluche mirando lo cotidiano, dibujos transformaban el invierno en gran verano. Papá me regaló bajo mi insistencia un juego que trataba de compartir la solvencia. Pero en el patio hicieron la competencia, fue cuando sentí mi primera impotencia. 1970, 1970, 1970, 1977. No me diga no, no lo presiento. Todo lo que cambia lo hará diferente en el año.
That's awesome.
So that's Anna Tijoux. I believe she's born in France, but her family's Chilean, and she's very big in Latin America, I think.
I don't know if it's because it's a different language, but it is crazy how fast she's talking.
Isn't it? Yeah. It just sounds so fluid. She's got it's swagger, like she's too.
Going, yeah, it's like she's going so fast, but also sounds like kind of like she couldn't care less in a way.
You know, uh-huh,
like,
very nonchalant.
I'm doing this and, yeah, it's cool. Jordan said, when I told him we were doing foreign language stuff, he's like, oh, Steele's going to do some French stuff.
Like, I almost did, but I guess she is French, but she is speaking
in
Spanish.
Yeah, it's Spanish. I'll have to tell him.
So this next one is Natalia Lafourcade. This song is called Aventurera. And this is one that we got on a mixtape that was sent to us from Amy. And she always makes great mixtapes. And this is another one where she has awesome pants on.
Okay.
Dale el precio del dolor a tu pasado. Diamantes, su pecado.
That's like a honey voice. Oh, it's like oozing sweetness. That's a great voice, Emmeline.
We listened to that one in the car, like nice and loud.
Aww. That sounds like summer.
Yeah, exactly. With the windows rolled down. Mm-hmm. That's perfect.
That's a sweet breeze.
Not a Las Vegas summer. Yeah, a nice summer
somewhere. Yeah. All right. Rose, you know more about Korean indie pop than anyone I know. And I'm sure you've got something else great for us here today.
Well, this is a band called Glen Check. They mostly don't do remixes. They mostly do their own stuff. And it's actually mostly in English. And they do a pretty good job at English. But they do some remixes that are pretty fun. And this is a remix of a Korean pop hip-hop group called GD and TOP. And the song is called Jibe Kajima, which is Don't Go Home. And it's super cutesy anyway. And then they kind of danced it up, I guess. So...
I was feeling a little Michael Jackson vibe in there a little bit.
Yeah, with that falsetto going on. Yeah. The original version is fun too, but I like this one the best.
Great. Okay, well, Rose, this last one is also for you. This is a Welsh group.
Super Furry Animals.
They are the one. And I don't know how to say this or what it means, but I would guess Imiladi ar Yimilon. But how do you pronounce that?
You'd say Amilodi. I'm alone.
Sounds so much better. And does that mean something? I don't know what that means.
It's like joining loose ends, I guess.
Awesome. Well, here's a Super Furry Animal song in Welsh for you, Rose. I don't know what they're saying, and I don't even want to know. That just feels good enough as it is.
You know,
that is like no other language. It's so cool.
Yeah, there aren't very many like related languages.
We're going to have a special Welsh edition of the podcast, Rose, if you do the translations for us. We want to make it inroads down in Cardiff.
Yeah, I don't. I think it's, my Welsh is too rusty now, so nah.
Well, let's do, Rose, would you mind just recording the book wisdom?
Yeah, that's totally fine. This is from a memoir by a man named Howard Norman. He's a professor at the University of Maryland. It's called I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place, which I think is one of the coolest titles for a book ever. The memoir is kind of, it's a lot about life and death and the way life changes and how we deal with those changes. The story that the title of the book comes from is Howard Norman was working in Nova Scotia, taking down verbal folk stories from the Inuit people. And there was one woman that he came across who, she was a really great verbal storyteller, and she also wrote her own poetry. She told him about a story about a man who was changed into a goose by a malevolent shaman. You know, it's a folk tale. It's allegorical. He'd had a really wonderful life in the village that he lived in. He'd never had any reason to leave it. And he was changed into a goose. And as the other geese are leaving, are flying south for the winter, he realizes that he's going to have to fly south too or die. And so he, in his goose language now, cries out a lament. I hate to leave this beautiful place. I hate to leave this beautiful place. And Howard Norman, like several years later, went back to that same area. And the woman that told him this story and who was a great poet had died. And one of the musicians in the village had put some of her poetry to music. And this made me think a little bit of Steele because of your love of poetry.
Great.
But, so this is what he put together. I like the wind in my hair. I like the sun on my face. The airplanes waiting on the dirt runway. But I hate to leave this beautiful place. This beautiful place, this beautiful place. I hate to leave this beautiful place. Hmm. And that's it.
That's how I feel about being in the world too, Rose.
Me too.
I really do, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, it's a really good book too. You should check it out.
It's called I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place. That's a memorable title.
Yep.
Great. Thanks so much, Rose.
You're welcome.
Well, the time has just flown. It has been an absolute delight, Rose, Emmeline. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And I think it went so well that we're probably not going to invite Dave back. So if one of you can commit to being permanent full-time host, we'd really appreciate it.
Well, you could just be an honorary woman.
Thank you. That's the greatest compliment anyone's ever paid me, Emily.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
Hi. We know we eat out there. We have to get some fresh air. So we'll have to do that, and then we'll go to bed and brush my teeth. I made a fort up in my room, and it was so much fun, and Addie went in. He loved it so much.